And the reality is, everything that you do has a purpose in your life, even if you don't know what that purpose is, right? We were not spontaneously combusted into earth to simply breathe air and die.
Okay. I'm super excited to welcome you to this episode of the Unstoppable Woman Spotlight. And this is going to be a regular feature on the Unstoppable Woman podcast. And I love this concept. And I'm super thrilled to welcome Allison Williams to the first episode. And let me do a little bit of an introduction. And then we're just going to jump right into some Q&A and get down and dirty with what it takes to be unstoppable and scale your business. So Allison Williams is the owner of not one, but two companies. Not only does she own Williams Law Group, a multi-million dollar law firm specializing in matrimonial and family law with an emphasis on complex child welfare matters, which she scaled by, check it out, 856% in 4 years. By the way, Allison, I love the specificity there. But she went on to take the skills that she learned in that journey to start a second business, Law Firm Mentor, where she provides business coaching services for solo and small law firm attorneys, helping them grow their revenues, crush chaos in business, and make more money. Great, thanks, if you ask me. Now, Allison has been a private client of mine and is also part of my Source of Wealth program. And although these contributed and continue to contribute to her success started way in advance of both of these. So we're going to go back to the beginning and start from the beginning. And then I also want to say, if you want to check out Allison's work or need her law services or her law mentoring, that her contact information is going to be in the show notes. And please go check her out. I know she has a lot to offer, including her own podcast with brilliance. So welcome.
Thank you for having me, Amira. I'm really excited to be here.
Awesome. Okay. So the idea behind these spotlights, I want to give a little framework so that you know and our listeners know, is to shed light on what it actually takes to be unstoppable in scaling your business. The real challenges behind it, how you move through them, the mindset pieces, you know, the mental aspect of success, and what tools and strategies you actually used. Because we all know it's never an overnight success. You did something tremendous in 4 years and you're still growing and it's still like going gangbusters. But none of that happened overnight. There was stuff way before that and continued part of it that contributes. But of course, it can be quicker than we ever expected to be. And doing what you did in 4 years is truly phenomenal. So I wanna break it down and kind of pull back the curtains on what that took, because I think I think it's an inspiration for people to hear how quickly it can happen, but they also go into a place of if it takes me longer than that, something's wrong with me, or that happened just overnight without a ton of effort and hard work and changing the mindset pieces and moving through the blocks, but we can shortcut it and then discount it as not possible for us, when in fact it's possible for everyone. And I want to show them the step. Okay. So let's start with a little bit about your story. Can you tell me when did you start the law firm and what the impetus was, and then how did the second business come into play?
Okay, so Amira, you mentioned mindset, and that's always where I start with my clients because I think it's the most important piece. So I'll be honest, I had not done any mindset work whatsoever. I was a lawyer. I was a very successful lawyer working in a law firm. I had been fired at the height of the recession in 2009 and then ultimately landed at a smaller firm and was building my reputation throughout the state of New Jersey in child abuse and neglect law, and had established a pretty decent book of business. I had about $500,000 in revenue coming to me just through word of mouth reputation. And at some point I went to my bosses, you know, a trio of three great guys, and said, hey guys, I think this whole title thing is problematic. I want the title of partner. And literally all that I wanted was the title of partner. And the boss that I went to said, oh, I think that's absolutely the time. I think you've demonstrated yourself. You've done everything you need to. Let me go talk to the guys and get back to you. And then when he came back to me, his answer was, well, we have to think about it. We're not certain. And honestly, I was just so offended by that I said, all right, well, you go think about it and I'll be over here. And then made the decision that night I was leaving, precipitously picked myself up and left within a couple of months of that declaration internally, and went and started a business. And I thought, okay, I was a great lawyer when I was working for someone else. I'll be a great lawyer on my own. And that was such, you know, I'm trying to use politically correct language here. That was such the wrong thing to believe. there's a lot more to running a business, let alone starting it and kind of launch padding. So I had never had a worry about clients, but trying to manage all of the minutiae, all of the moving pieces of getting the right people on the team and delegating work to them and getting them to do the work at the quality that I wanted, and choosing the right vendors to work in the business and putting my message out in the right way. All of that was completely foreign to me and it was overwhelming. So kind of early on in the process, I started my law firm, things are cooking, and I am hiring very poorly. So I hired the third very poor hire and finally said, you know what, I'm not going to hire anybody. I'm just going to do this on my own, right? The quintessential stupid mistake that women tend to make, right? So I'm going to do it on my own. And I decided that I would get up every day, drive 45 minutes to work, be a secretary from 6 a.m. to 9 o'clock, a lawyer from 9 to 7. 7 o'clock, I take my little break, have a snack and shovel in some crap while I'm reviewing emails, and then work until 9 o'clock as a secretary and rinse and repeat that process daily over several weeks until about week 6. That wore me out to the point where I fell asleep driving 90 miles an hour and almost hit a guardrail. And that was kind of my wake up moment, if you will, that I needed help.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So you talked about some of those initial challenges. What did you do to, you had the wake up call, and then what did you do next? What did you do to take action quickly, I imagine, to solve that problem?
Well, so again, I hadn't done any mindset work, so I wish I could say I did the gallant thing of going out and seeking help, but I really said, screw it, I'm done with this, and sold myself to the highest bidder and got a lucrative offer to be someone's employee. And finally, on my way to sign that paperwork, again, had another wake-up call of, what am I doing? Something is telling me to hold on to this business. I don't know why, but I'm just going to follow that. And that was kind of the first time I would say I really followed spirit and just kind of stepped into, this feels right, even though intellectually it seems wrong on paper. And from that point, I then started looking for resources. So I started working with different coaches and found my way into the right mindset work. I mean, it was... Yes, I got logistical work of, you know, how to hire people and how to market. And those things are important. Those are absolutely essential. But I really got help with understanding why, which was the most important thing for me, why I was running at breakneck speed to be successful when I was already successful, why I was so terrified of failing, why I took everything personally. I was just a very emotionally damaged person. And my emotional damage made me very successful as a lawyer, because I kind of put on the armor, the crust around me to protect myself and to advocate, but it made me very ineffective as a leader. And when I wanted to evolve my business, I really had to grow in leadership, which is really about growing your mindset. And that's how I found my first true mastery of mindset coaching process, and then ultimately got into working with you, where I continued to grow and evolve and get to where I needed to.
So let's talk about leadership for a moment, because that's one of my questions for you. Like, what would you say your leadership style is, and maybe what it was? Like, what is the, how has it evolved, and how has it helped you? Like, now, how has it helped you? Like, be who you are and get to the level that you've gotten to, but also where right now do you think it's holding you back, and where did it hold you back before? Like, speak to a little bit of how it's evolved and how you continue to evolve with that.
Sure. So once upon a time, I had the mistaken belief that everyone saw the world the way that I did. And I know, shocker, That's not true. I mean, intellectually, of course, I know that that's not true, and I knew it then. But on some level, instinctually, my thought was, okay, as long as I tell you what to do and I give you clear instruction and I give you my expectations, you're going to rise to the occasion of getting things done. And then I started encountering people not wanting to work as hard as I did, not wanting to come in early and leave late and work on weekends, not having a dedication to people in the same way that I did. And so I didn't know how to get the best out of people other than tell them what to do generally and what outcome. And I also gave them a lot more freedom than I ever expected would be needed, because frankly, I always thrived in having the space to be able to carve my own way. But that really is kind of an entrepreneurial calendar talent, right? As opposed to someone with an employee mindset who can be a very effective employee, but needs a little bit more structure and guidance. And so I had to let go of the idea that if I say so, it is so. And then I had to evolve into believing that you have to empower people, but you do have to both lead and manage. And if you are not the manager, you have to lead from a place of delegating to the right people to manage the team so that the work still gets done. And so that is still my biggest point of growth. That's where I have had the most growth, and that is where I still continue to need to do the most growth. I still instinctually go into do-it-myself mode rather than delegating. I still instinctually fight the urge to train up other people. The thought comes to my mind at least once a day, I can do this better than so-and-so, so I'll just do it myself. And I also very much struggle with trying to be both positive and empowering to people, letting people know that there is a way that they can do it, that I believe in them, while at the same time holding them to very, very high standards and firm guidelines. And where the difficulty there is that your people issues are always going to come up when you're deciding in your mind, do I, you know, punish this person for not meeting a very, very high expectation, or do I say 95% is good enough, even though it's not what I asked for? How do I debate that in my mind in a way that comes from what is best for my business rather than what's best for my ego or what's best for my sense of entitlement that I gave you this, so you should be able to? And that's something that, you know, is just a work in progress, and it's probably my Achilles heel that will be here until I am no longer.
Well, let's set a different expectation around that. Why don't we?
Well, I don't want to have a defeatist attitude about it. I do believe that you can improve yourself out of a problem. But I guess my point of saying that really for everyone that's listening is that I think you have to accept where your weaknesses are and recognize that you can still be immensely successful, notwithstanding weaknesses that other people don't struggle with, right? This is my issue, but there are some things other people struggle with that are not an issue for me at all. Right. Correct. We all are our unique person that, you know, that strengths and weaknesses, and we just have to know what they are and work around them.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting debate out there about, you know, do you just focus on your strengths and really dial those in and make those great, and the weaknesses, it's like you delegate everything that you're weak in, or do you try and improve the places of where you're weak, where, you know, that you have challenges, and bring that up to a certain level. And some people say it's not worth doing that, and some people say it is worth doing that. Where do you stand?
I think it's a little of both. I do think that your greatest power lies in your strengths. So I do think you should always start with your strengths, end with your strengths, and be in that energy. But I do think that there is a certain minimum level of competence you need to have as a leader, as a business owner. You can't not know how to hire people, even if you're going to ultimately outsource that. You know, anything that you're outsourcing, you need to have a minimum level of competence around, particularly sales. So it's very important that you get to a point where you understand the parameters of it, you can hold people to expectations. And yes, if it's not your area of expertise, you go do you, but you've got to get great people around you to do everything else. And in order to get great people, you have to know what greatness looks like in that particular skill set.
Absolutely. I think it's true around sales. I think it's true around, a lot of people have challenges around their accounting, their numbers, like really understanding what's going on there. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm never going to be an accountant. I'm never going to be a CFO. That is not my strength, but I need to know enough so I know what's profitable, how to spend my money, how to invest, what's worth it. And that's been a work in progress, right? You get better at it, just like you get better at sales, just like you get better at leading a team, hiring, marketing, all of that. and you, in my mind, you will have lanes that you're better in, but that there needs to be a certain level of capacity so you don't do that ostrich thing where you're hiding from it and quite frankly, opening yourself up to a lot of problems where people can take advantage of situations, you know, make decisions that you wouldn't make, you know, lead the company unintentionally or intentionally in a negative place. So I think one needs to have a certain level of confidence, check in every so often, and then hire really great people. So,
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's something to be said for associating with or surrounding yourself with people who are more expert at something than you are. I think a lot of us have a fear of not being the smartest person in the room. So we say, you know, I don't want somebody who's going to be better at this than me because God forbid, then they could take advantage of me, like you said, or, you know, they could steer me in the wrong direction. But, you know, part of getting that education piece in is having someone who's exceptional at something so that they can be the leader in that area. Now, of course, that means that they're going to be educating you as the owner and the business leader, right? So they're going to be teaching you what they know. If they're just kind of off doing something, that's where you get the ostrich factor, and that's where you can be taken advantage of.
Yeah. And you need to know enough in order to hire, to know if you're hiring a really good person or not.
That's a yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Next question for you. Now, you're a powerhouse. You are still going gangbusters with your businesses, both of them. Okay. You're driven, you're focused, you're making great progress. But as you know, we often can't see for ourselves what we can't see for ourselves, right? There are blind spots. There are places where we're blocked. How do you recognize when you're actually blocked in a situation? And what do you do when you realize that? What are your actual strategies around that?
Okay, so there's a couple of answers to that. The first one is that I don't always recognize when I'm blocked. Like sometimes I think the answer is a very strategic, tactical, analytical answer, right? This marketing is not working because I'm not writing the right copy, or I don't have the right avatar, or I don't have the right images, or my call to action isn't strong enough, right? So I will go to the analytical place, and much more often than not, that's not the answer. Sometimes it is the answer. Sometimes it really is about the tactical, but it really is oftentimes that I'm not seeing something that I am doing or failing to do that's holding me back. And so that's where coaching is really vital, because the more that somebody else can see you and shine a light on even small things, right? If somebody knows what your patterns are, they're much more able to see where you are slipping into a pattern that you thought you had eradicated that now, you know, it's kind of showing up again. And so that's part of it, is not seeing it. The second part is when I do see it, oftentimes I will know, yeah, this is me 101, right? Me 101 goes into the pattern of not dealing with an issue, or my most common problem is with people, right? I have more empathy for other people than I have for myself, which I know is, you know, it's a self-worth issue. It's a patterned behavior. I think women are taught that in society in general, but some of us have it worse than others. And so that's something that I always work on. Like, am I being more empathetic toward others than myself? And oftentimes I don't see that, or I see it, but I don't have the wherewithal to stop it. Like I might say in a moment, yeah, this person is not profitable, but they have a family. I can't fire someone with a family. Or, oh my God, they have a family member with an illness. I can't possibly let that person go. Or I can't hold this person to a higher standard because I don't believe that they're more capable. Maybe my standards are too high, or maybe I'm expecting too much. And oftentimes when I hear that loop in my head, I know the answer, right? I know what you would say to me. I know what I would say to my clients if I heard that. But I don't have the wherewithal, or I don't want to say the courage. Part of it is courage, but I think it's really, you don't have the intestinal fortitude to be uncomfortable, being unpopular, making hard decisions. And a lot of us are triggered by that now, in particular, because of what's going on with the coronavirus. And, you know, we have to make decisions about who is on the team, who's off the team. And that is oftentimes where I go into, you know, pulling upon the resources of others. You know, the Source of Wealth Mastermind is just an exceptional place for me, because all of the women in the group are their own brand of genius. Like they all have something that I don't have, so that they can model things to me. They can just talk to me about how they would solve the problem. And it might not be my way, but it gives me things to draw upon that I wouldn't have come up with on my own. There's a creative faculty that comes with sharing the problem and then sharing the solutions. And so that's another area where I would go to and say, this is where I can improve myself just instinctually without necessarily even looking for an answer. Sometimes it's directly looking for it. And sometimes it's just being in the space of other bright people who are solving their own problems. And then you see something in the way that you're doing things that you didn't even know was a problem, but that somebody highlights through the resolution of their own issue.
Yeah. And it sounds like as part of that, there's a certain amount of vulnerability that you have to step into in order to receive those ideas, that creative faculty, that advice. Like you have to put yourself out there and say, this is what's happening for me in my business. And as a leader in your own world, you run two businesses, you have a ton of employees, that's not always accessible to you, right? That you have to hold a standard for the people around you, and you have to have a strong, not a fake leadership, but there's a true leadership there. And there's a time and a place to share things, and there's a time and a place not to. And that this environment that you're in with the source of wealth allows you to be vulnerable. Can you talk a little bit, not just with this group, but just in general, about like the challenges around being vulnerable? Because I think personally, I think this is a big thing for really smart, ambitious, driven, on it, go-getter type women, that showing up and sharing, you know, the truth of what's going on can be a little bit challenging. So yeah, that's a good pitch, but there you yeah. go.
So, you know, it's interesting. I think most leaders can say, or even aspiring leaders can look at a situation and say, yeah, I probably shouldn't tell my staff I'm scared, you know, I'm scared out of my wits and have no idea what we're doing, right? That probably isn't going to engender the level of confidence and security that people are going to need in order to be successful in their roles. So intellectually, I think that's the easy part. But where I think most of us probably fall short in being vulnerable is that you don't always know how deep the problem is. Like you may know you have certain things that you're not doing well. Like maybe you don't look at your numbers. Maybe you know that you're scared to look at your numbers because they're going to tell you you don't have enough, and you're going to have a lack mindset that's going to be triggered by that. And so that can be paralyzing, and you might intellectually understand that and be able to voice that to someone, whether it's an accountant, a CFO, a group of other business leaders, right? But you may not know that what that comes from is the idea that you don't feel that you're good enough. And so if you don't think that you're good enough, you don't think that you're going to be able to solve the problem. And so there's a whole other layer underneath the onion that you have to peel away. And then that causes a lot of just triggers. Like, you know, it causes oftentimes crying. It can cause you destabilizing thoughts. It can oftentimes spin you into a pattern of, you know, I'm just not going to deal with this because it's too much to deal with. And having a space where you can have those kinds of conversations, where people can shine a light on you, where they're not necessarily doing it from a place of, you know, yes, they want to help you, but part of it is that just by virtue of being in the space with other people where you are in a constant state of looking for what's wrong and applying universal law principles, it becomes a non-judgmental space. And I think what stops a lot of people is the fear that if I tell somebody, I don't look at my numbers because I don't think I'm worthy of having this much, or I don't look at my numbers because I don't think that I'm good enough to create more if there's not enough. Most people fear someone's going to hear that and think I'm an idiot, or they're going to hear that and say, what's wrong with you? Or they're going to say, spoiled little rich girl. Like, you know, why is this an issue? Like a lot of people have fear around making more because of how other people will see them. And if you're in a space where people are all struggling with that on some level, even the super, super, super successful. I've been in masterminds and groups with people that own like multi-million dollar businesses. I was actually in a mastermind once with, ironically, all men. And one of them had a multi-billion dollar company. And some of the same stuff came up, right? Men process it differently than women do, but the same issues are there. And if there's something necessary about having that safe space to surround yourself with people who are looking at you and seeing all the brilliance, but also seeing all of the areas where you need to grow without judging it, that allows you the freedom to own it, process it, and deal with it.
Right. I think that's so important. That idea, I speak about it as like, it's like, own your brilliance, own your wisdom, own your strength and value. And also, here's where I need help. And being able to be whole in whole, both of those is just such a rich gift. So a couple of times, Allison, you've mentioned, women versus men, things like that. Now, where do you think there are unique challenges or advantages to being a woman, either in your field or more generally as an entrepreneur?
So this is such a loaded question for me. as a lawyer and as a litigator in particular, I spent most of my time in my masculine energy. I'm very directive rather than collaborative. You know, I have a need to be right. I focus on objective results rather than the process. That has a place, but that also has a weakness. And I think that women don't often, they're not often as aware of the fact that we have a strength when we can balance both energies, I think just far more effectively than men can. Men have feminine energy just like women do, but collaborating, being a supportive force, being nurturing, looking for improving the feeling rather than improving the thought can oftentimes be a feminine strength that we don't draw into. And so what ends up happening is you either tend toward one or the other, right? You don't balance the two. But women have the best ability to balance the two, which means we can be hard driving in a boardroom and telling people what to do. We can be the boss. We can be the authority. But we can also lead with empathy, concern ourselves with other people, bring people into the fold more than men do, which means more bright minds and then ultimately more ability to scale. So it really is that I think women not aware of that will either judge their femininity and say, oh, I'm soft, or, I wish I was more of a powerhouse. I wish I could do more of the masculine way. Or they have such a value for the feminine that they believe everything masculine is evil or bad or negative. And they don't really step into the idea of just kind of allowing both sides of yourself to express themselves as they need to fit the circumstances in your business. So there are times when I am full on, in my feminine energy, where I'm going around to make sure that everyone's okay. I'm concerned about their emotional well-being. I'm pouring into them and being a supportive force because that's what's needed to keep them surviving and thriving in today's age. And there are other times where I'm the boss, I'm the authority, I'm the dictator to some degree, and I'm saying I'm going to have it my way and this is how it's going to be. And that also gives a certain level of comfort and assurance. Like, okay, that's the leader because that's the person who's telling me how it's going to be. And I follow that. And so there is something I think genuinely special about being a woman that allows us to tap into both of those energies much more so than men do, even though super powerful men do it as well.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Okay. Next question for you. What is an example of seeing of a seemingly big failure or mistake at the time you saw it that way? Okay. Or yeah, at the time you saw it that way, that now from this place in time that you look back and you can see some huge lesson for it from it, some way that it really adjusted your business, your trajectory in a very positive way. I think it's really what I'm looking for here, Allison. So again, underhanded pitch here is I think there's a struggle that many women face where they're afraid of making mistakes, or they've made big mistakes in the mistakes, and I'm going to put that in quotes, in the past, that they haven't worked through or forgiven or seen the value from. And my experience and what I coach my clients with is that there's always a lesson, and the faster that you see it, the faster that you can translate the experience into something that is positive, the faster you'll get to the next level in your business. Otherwise, it becomes this anchor that holds you back. So I'm interested in giving our listeners an example of that so that they know that this is the truth, that it's common, that you do actually, that they're not alone in this, and that they should shame and guilt themselves into not really accepting the lesson and moving forward. Yeah.
Okay. So this lesson actually starts, this mistake, we'll call it, starts at the start of my journey as an entrepreneur. So like a lot of business owners, I was afraid to do it on my own. And when you know, there's something different about kind of having a job and doing a side hustle that you're growing into a business versus what I did, which is I was practicing child abuse and neglect in a law firm. I was the only lawyer that had that practice area. So there really was no ability for my clients to remain with my employer or ability for my employer to take my clients, right? So I had 43 human beings who I was responsible for and their children and their ability to see their children. And I picked all of that up, which was its own full business, and dropped it off somewhere else and then had no systems or structure around it, which was just chaos, right? But when I did that, I actually went out into business with a partner because I can't do it on my own. You know, how am I ever going to figure this out? And it's too overwhelming and I've got too much to do. And my partner now, he and I are in a good place. But at the time we put ourselves together, we liked each other as people. I think we respected each other as people. And we had a division of labor. I was going to be the hard pressing, driving, working person, working partner. And he was going to be kind of the oversight of the management, the money person, the person who acquires things for us. And that worked for a period of time until I realized that I was producing a lot more than my partner. So whether you agree or not, it felt like at the time I was generating a lot more money and that didn't seem fair to me. And my partner had a lot less work to do. And so there was only so much that I could tolerate of that. We ultimately broke ourselves apart in about 7 months. But what happened was I went out in business and I did what I think most people did. Oh my God, I own a business. How exciting is this? And posted it on every social media platform that I could. That was before Facebook business pages were a thing. I made it a thing in my business. So I posted something on my page every day. Look, I'm building my empire. We're doing this. And then clients started to come and referrals came. And I was very successful at creating this big mystique around this thing that I had created, the firm of Paragano and Williams. And then when it ended rather abruptly, my partner and I kind of had a moment, we decided to end up the business and literally divorced ourselves in 30 days. So, you know, disbanded LLCs, separated, had to get new leases, get new space, all of that. And that was humiliating for me. That was the most public failure I had ever had in my life. In fact, I wasn't one that failed often. I considered it a failure if I lost an application in court, but most people will tell you family law is very dependent on what judges think, and a judge can get the law wrong and they have discretion in family law. So even if you are exceptional and everybody thinks you are, you can still lose. So on some level, those failures, as I might have perceived them, really weren't failures, right? They were just par for the course of being a lawyer. But this was, I started a business and it didn't make it a year, right? Forget how much money it had in it. We had plenty of money, but I had publicly told the world, I have created this thing that is going to be the next coming of all things family law. And I told everybody how fabulous it was. And I was shouting it from the rooftops. And the next day, oh yeah, never mind. And that was so crippling that, you know, I had previously had a period in my time of my life where I suffered from anxiety. That resurfaced. I started having panic attacks. I would wake up in the middle of the night and just not be able to function. I would be in court and just out of the blue, like nothing at all related to the business would even come up. I would just all of a sudden start crying and not be able to stop crying and go into the bathroom and have to like cry for an hour before I could come back out again and people wouldn't know where I was. I mean, this is how destabilizing it was. And, you know, and I didn't really have much choice but to keep going. And at some point see it as I had to go through that in order to realize 1,001 things I needed in business, i.e. that I'm capable of doing it on my own, that people came to the business for me because I was what was putting things out, i.e. I was attracting what I was putting out, that there is a way to manage being the leader and the doer at the same time and evolve yourself out of that there is a way to get the right people on your team, that you don't have to do it on your own, that you can create systems while you are also doing the work of the business. Like I got so much out of that failure. And the most important thing I got out of it is that people still wanted me as a lawyer. Like I didn't have any drop off in business. In fact, if anything, I had to stop taking new clients because I just at that point had 50 some odd clients and no structure. So I had to go create that. But, you know, people still came for me. And I think there was kind of this feeling like I'm not good enough, so I have to work harder. And now the one thing I thought made me valid, which was having the endorsement of another person who would partner with me, I lost that. So I thought I lost my value to the marketplace. And quite the opposite was true. In fact, you know, we started to exponentially grow when I separated from my partner, because then the message became about me and what I was putting out, not necessarily about this compromised version of us that really didn't exist. It was just two people that stuck themselves together. Something that I work with law firm owners a lot on.
Yeah. It sounds like it really actually increased your self-worth tremendously, right? It allowed you to really see what you were capable of and what your worthiness level kind of raised up quite significantly there. Okay, so that's an example of something kind of crashing and burning around you. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about that. Okay, how do you keep going when everything around you seems to be falling apart? Like, what advice would you give to entrepreneurs and empire builders around this idea that it's not always pretty? There are times where things get messy in business. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first thing I would always tell people that are in the situation of stuff going wrong and thinking I should just quit, this is not working for me, is to go back to why you started in the first place. Like some people have a huge vision. They have a, you know, I am put on this earth to do the thing. And then the thing has its own purpose-driven focus for you. But there are a lot of people that don't know why they do what they do. Like they fell into a practice area or they fell into a business and they say, well, you know, if it doesn't have a resonance with me, then why am I still doing this? Why, you know, it's not working. So it must be that it wasn't meant to be or something like that. And the reality is, everything that you do has a purpose in your life, even if you don't know what that purpose is, right? We were not spontaneously combusted into earth to simply breathe air and die. You know, there is something that every human being was put on earth to do. And so if you don't know what that is, that can be harder. But if you know what that is, focus on it. And that's really about putting down on paper what you get out of what you do. And I tell my clients this all the time. If you are not happy with a moment in time, realize that it's a moment in time. And what helps you with that is all of the good things that come out of your experience. So one of the examples of assignments that I give to my clients all the time is the 100 things exercise. Whenever you have a lot of frustration, anxiety, toxic thoughts, negative thoughts around something, find 100 things that are positive about the negative experience. And most people say, I couldn't possibly come out with 100 things, right? Maybe I can come up with 10, maybe 15. I said, no, the number is 100. And you have to force yourself to keep coming up with things. And so a lot of times my clients have a hard time with this. So they'll get to like maybe 40 or 50, and then we'll hop on the phone together and then we'll walk through the continuation of it. And oftentimes the one positive thing that they write has 7 or 8 different branches that they don't see. Right. And so I can model that back to them the same way that you've done for me. Like modeling it back is really what the value of coaching is. And so we'll go through and draw out all of the positive. And by the time we get to the third thing on their list, they're saying, oh, there were really 50 things out of the first 3. I missed all of that opportunity. And then they get recharged. And that recharging then is on paper. It's something that you can look at every single night. The gratitude practice is one thing that I live by, which is writing the 3 things that went right every single day, right? Even when you're tired, even when you had a really crappy day, what are the 3 things that you can find that went right about that day? And always compare that with the 100 things that are good about your negative experience. And then you start to rewire your brain to be looking for the positive and the negative, and pretty soon the negative lifts.
Yeah, this is all about perspective and a lot, you know, this is the law of relativity at play. What are you going to focus on? Nothing is big or small until you compare it to something else. Let's compare this situation to 100 things that are good about it. And suddenly the negative is not as big as we thought it was. It doesn't overpower us anymore. Huge. Okay. So my last question for you, Allison, is what does it mean to you to be an unstoppable woman? And how do you remain unstoppable?
All right. So that's two questions.
One. I think we're in there.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So first part of that question, what does it mean to be unstoppable? I think, you know, the key crux of that is it's all about committing yourself to an end result. And committing yourself to an end result doesn't mean that you're going to have a perfect linear trajectory from when you decide to do something to when you get there, right? There are going to be hills and valleys, ups and downs. Things are going to come at you that are going to feel awful. You're going to get derailed, right? None of us expected that coronavirus was going to find its way in the middle of our business plan in 2020, but that's life, right? You have to say, what is my end result? If you focus on the end result, then the way to achieve it become something that comes to you instead of I'm going to focus on the plan. And then if something comes up and the plan didn't work anymore, oh crap, I guess I have to stop now. Right. Cause if you're committed to the plan as opposed to the end result, you know, plans change and, you know, plans change all the time. Now in terms of how you remain unstoppable, this is really about faith, right? In my view, faith is not a religious practice. It really is that you have to tap into what there is inside of you that is urging you forward toward whatever your end result is. And that could be service of others. That could be service to God. If you believe in God, that could be service to yourself. There could be something that you desire. All of the things that we create have a purpose. And I think we oftentimes minimize the value of the things that we create so that we say, oh, I only did this or I just did that. But the reality is there's a human being that's out there trying to do the exact same thing that you just intentionally or unintentionally did that took you 5 minutes that they've been struggling to do for a lifetime. Like we underplay our value so much. And if we focus on what it is that we're aiming to do and we just commit ourselves to that knowing that it's in us and a desire for us to have that for some reason, then you can stop debating yourself about whether you should pursue it and you can just stay the course. No matter what happens in the interim, it's all about where the finish line is.
Love it. Love it. Desire is causative and faith is huge. You've got to have faith. So with that, let's call it a wrap. Thank you so much, Allison. Brilliant nuggets, like in everything you said. I hope people listen to this and then listen to it again and then listen to it again. Because I think you'll hear a number of different things each time you listen to it, because there are layers in what she has to say, has said. So thank you so much, Allison. Really grateful for you taking the time to share your wisdom.
Thank you for having me, Amira. This was great.
Okay, right on.
Thank you so much for joining us and for being a part of the Unstoppable Woman movement. I want to let you know that we've got a ton of free resources for you for scaling your business at theunstoppablewoman.com/free stuff. Please go ahead and check those out. And we'd also love your help in getting the message out. Share this podcast with all the unstoppable women in your life, your friends, your colleagues, your business besties. Please do that. And if you're game, we'd super duper duper appreciate a review on iTunes as well. Thanks so much and be